Tonight is the inaugural Western Bait Lecture, which we hope to make an annual part of the Sovereign Health Calendar. It will be an oration for professionals in the field of history, wherever they may practice, from schools or universities or museums or government. And what we'd like to do is to make this oration a way of highlighting new work, especially in the work of local history. And that's where Western has really made such an important contribution. We in Ballarat are particularly attuned to the service Western has provided this city for more than about four decades as its historian. Lucky City and its sequel Life After Gold were groundbreaking in bringing serious scholarship to the field of local history and giving local history its place as a fundamental building block in understanding our national story. And that work has really stood the test of time, particularly here at Sovereign Hill. There wouldn't be a day that goes by that someone is not referring to Lucky City. And it's not only for the authority of its content, it's also for the vivacity and verve and the way the story is told. Tonight, Western's going to talk to us about why Victoria was different. And it's my very great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Western Bait.
Thank you, Peter. Well, my friends, what a letdown. I'll have to dramatise vigorously. Thank you. I attended a function here this morning when David Hill was talking about his book, Gold. And it's a wonderful sort of sequel, I suppose you could say, at a different level, to Geoffrey Blainey's Rush That Never Ended, where Blainey's talking about mining history from the miner's point of view, and David has tracked the people, the grassroots experience of that huge influence of gold on the Australian community. I don't really think it's an accurate title. Inaugural. So I'm going to change it. It's an inaugural lecture. I'm going to auger deep into the story of Victoria and its democracy. Victoria was the democratic pace setter, not just in this country, but in the world. How do we understand it? We need concepts, and they're often lacking. What I want to start with is the fact that Victoria was perhaps unique in the world in having two powerful foundations. We were saved from convicts. The failure of the 1803 settlement at Sorrento granted Victoria its free enterprise beginnings and granted it the possibilities of 32 years of perfecting the pastoral system, which isn't just putting sheep to work. It's about the links with Britain in capital, manufacturing, the market for wool, and the links that Melbourne merchants established in getting the right channels operating to make the wool process work well. This, of course, was a British system. It's a gentry-based system. It's looking at the land with that special force that's been there for centuries. It's tied to British capital. It's tied to the British government's idea of what a colony should be, serving the mother country. Two foundations set up a dynamic society in Victoria because the foundation that followed the gold experience was swamping, more powerful, but just as incisive as the pastoral. Weren't we lucky to have the two. And yet in many ways, unlucky as well, because the pastoral generation, with the pastoralists and the merchants and the government officials, had the chance to draft a constitution for Victoria that built in the power of that pastoral generation to block legislation in an upper house that couldn't be reformed. I blame the British government for allowing that to happen. They created the act that governed Victoria. Unlike New South Wales, unlike the House of Lords, they didn't allow our upper house to have any means of resolving the issue of obstructionism to the forces that were moving society. It's wonderful to stand here, as you might have found it wonderful to stand at the Port Phillip Heads and watch Sullivan Bay fail and the ships depart for Tasmania, and watch the fleets come in carrying the sheep that did all the work in the Western District. It's wonderful to stand here, where I believe the true spirit of Victoria, in its democratic sense, was created. That extraordinary power of gold, the swamping of the pastoral generation, five times as many new migrants came in a decade as had been here before. So the democratic mineral, as I like to call gold, because it's cash in your hand, it's currency, it's a marvellous mineral. And in the hands of these migrants who had better education than most in Britain, who had many skills, as you find out in the Ballarat story, they created a city in their own generation. This is a body of people who are empowered by that democratic mineral. They didn't have to borrow from Britain. They were free, individually and as communities. This is what I now like to call, in my old age, I've come to a new term, this is radical capitalism. Okay? Radical capitalism. It's got a power of putting money in the hands of a great wide group of people, never known before in the world. It's happened here. Why has it happened so strongly here? Because in the Ballarat Basin, labour and capital shook hands, and that remarkable group of people who tackled the Ballarat deep sinkings, risking all, whether they were the storekeepers who were putting their money into it, whether they were the miners who were risking their lives, and apart from the grub staking they got to keep them going for up to 8 months, they were risking their time, their young lives, in the pursuit of that mineral. It was a chance that no generation could ever have destroyed, have taken away from them. They had a sense of community that I don't think has been rivaled anywhere in this land. This is why Ballarat has always had a public spirit that outplays anything that Geelong or Bendigo or Melbourne has ever achieved. Sovereign Hill is witness to it. It lasted right through and still operates in Ballarat. Now, the quality of the migrants to whom this great gift was given was so marvellous that they had every skill at their hands. As you know, In Lucky City, it's clear that by 1860 there were 12 great metalworks in Ballarat. The capital for them emerged out of that gold, out of the need to provide engines and pumps to get the water out of those deep holes, and then to tackle the gold under the basalt, the buried streams. This challenge gave people confidence that they could do it. They built that city. They had in their hands marvellous opportunity. But of course, Anthony Trollope was mistaken when he said Ballarat was founded on nothing but gold. He was immensely impressed with it, the most remarkable place in Australia. But of course, as I argue in Lucky City, it was the hinterland that added so much. The Victorian gold fields were unusual in the world as being in country that was fertile, that had water, that had great forests. This was an unexampled opportunity for cheap living, for all the facilities that you needed. And out of it, as this community in Victoria developed, you get a really rare capital labour partnership, not just in our deep sinkings, but in the 8 hours movement. Put yourself at Melbourne University and march with the workers to the newly developing construction of Parliament House, Parliament House, and you get the sense that here are people who are willing to understand that everybody needs 8 hours rest, 8 hours recreation, as well as a stint of labour. And it's because the master stonemasons had been journeyman stonemasons themselves and sympathised with the workers that they granted them that remarkable 8 hour a day. To be a benchmark for this community in Victoria. And building on that, in the 1870s and the 1880s, at Creswick, W.G. Spence and David Temple developed a miners and a shearers union that believed that through their experience in the union, men would gain respect, self-respect, and that they would be transformed by the fellowship that developed among them. Because of the success here of the distance from Geelong, the natural protection that that afforded, we had the development of industry that then moved the Victorian society to stand against Britain, free trade Britain, which the pastoralists loved in their exchange of sheep for manufactured, wool for manufactured goods. We needed to employ this generation, and so we adopted a protectionist tariff to make sure that that opportunity for work continued. In the climate of Victoria, the politics became radical liberal politics. So radical capitalism generated radical liberal politics. And the great causes of the day against that intransigent legislative council were the selection acts, which were fought through immensely strongly in Victoria against New South Wales, where selection was on the whole a failure. But here they fought and fought it until they got really good selection acts. 1865, section 42, that gave small holdings around the goldfields and enabled farms, orchards, small holdings to be very successful. and of course then in the 1869 Act out into the Wimmera, giving the opportunity for harvesters and other agricultural implements to be manufactured in Ballarat and sent out by rail, drawn by Phoenix Foundry engines. In the 1870s, with selection, protection, payment of members of Parliament as the big issues emerging out of Eureka, the reform of the Legislative Council was a huge issue, and Graham Berry, grocer turned Premier, fought the Legislative Council and brought on that famous Black Wednesday, in which, because the Legislative Council had refused to pass a bill to which he had attached payment of members to make it permanent, because that was the way in which you got parliamentarians who didn't have to have their own sources of income, Berry went to London to see if he could break this impasse, asked the British government to give him the possibility through an Act of Parliament there to change this impasse in the Victorian Constitution. What hope did a grocer from a colony have in persuading the British that there should be some release from that overwhelming check on the work of the Legislative Assembly? Alongside this drive, or within this drive, was the work of Professor Pearson at the University of Melbourne. And just think of that. Pearson drew to him, with his great ideas about democracy, Alfred Deakin, John Quick, Henry Vaughan Higgins. Wow. Deakin, who is to be the epitome of radical liberalism, where the state was trying to ameliorate the condition of those who weren't doing so well, something that had happened already in this community through the old colonists, through the benevolent asylum, which became the Queen Elizabeth home. Quick, who found the way to get our nation to have a mechanism for achieving its federation. And of course Higgins, who against H.V. Mackay and his great harvester works achieved the fair wage, the fair go, that's probably been at the base of all democratic activity in Victoria. Fairness. It was fairness that inspired those who stood up against the Goldfields administration at Ballarat, fairness that made them go to the stockade. So what is the place of Eureka? It's the release of a new force. It's the death of the old. That Goldfields Commission, which should never have been allowed to go on for so long. That tax, which is used as a goad, and the methods of inspection of that tax, which were a terrible impost on the deep sinking miners. Despite that, a huge percentage of them went to protest meetings to say how bad they thought it all was. It's a rare occasion in the world where a failed uprising won a victory. It's a failed uprising because, in my analogy, my metaphor, the stockaders were the crest of the wave of protest. Not about democracy, about civil liberties. And the great body of the protest movement was what won the day. And really it was Melbourne and the people of Melbourne, who knew what had been going on, who held down ideas that the government should be supported against that wild mob who had gone to the stockade at Ballarat. The stockade was surely resistance. They might have been able to do something more than just say, we're going to defend those who burnt their licences. Or we're going to say, don't do another Thursday the 30th licence hunt on us. We've had enough of your overbearing and disastrously corrupt behaviour. So that what they were saying and what Henry Seacamp was, of all those who were arrested, successfully convicted, but not of treason as the others were, but of sedition in his Ballarat Times, for saying that all power comes from the people. And when you read Seacamp's editorials, if it was Seacamp and not Charles Manning who wrote them, but anyway, the editorials in the Ballarat Times, they may have seemed seditious at the time, and certainly he got to points where he said, we really ought to go and hit them. But basically, he was just expressing the truth about what was discovered, both in the inquiry into the burning of Bentley's Hotel and in the Royal Commission that followed Eureka, that in fact the fault lay with the government and not with the people. When Hotham rejected what was probably foolish, the demand of the deputation from a meeting in Ballarat to free the men who'd been arrested for the burning hotel, he thought they were stepping beyond what they ought to be doing. And there's a sense in which it was thought that they were asking for democracy, because they'd attached to their charter, the Ballarat Reform League charter, they'd attached the charter's goals. But in fact, the main part of the charter was expressing their grievances, and their move to Hotham was about the release of prisoners, not about democracy. They weren't asking for that, but they got it, because he had failed. Government had failed. Everything, you can rest now, everything came beautifully together in the 1880s, when marvellous Melbourne, when everybody got together, the Legislative Council, the Legislative Assembly got together, shook hands and said, all we want is development. A great Australian, new country goal. And they were all busy using government borrowing, as had begun in the 1860s with the construction of the railways to Bendigo and Ballarat, because this country could not support a capital private investment in the railway system, as we can't now straight away afford broadband, for instance. You had to take the risk of putting the democracy's money where its needs were. And in the 1880s, the Parliament decided that rail was absolutely necessary for the development of the country. So it was a mistake, but it was a sensible attempt. They put railway lines wherever they thought farmers might need them. And of course the pastoralists thought this was a great thing, easier to get their wool out and so on and so forth. So the 1883 Octopus Railway Act that Tommy Bent introduced as minister was a political stunt, but an economic ideal. Of course, the figures didn't support the attempt. I hope broadband will be better. the land boomers were in Parliament, and they were mostly Melbourne local politicians, so that the local communities got their rail links, so that the paddocks of the developers could be serviced by a communication system, which served for our Melbourne community for 4 or 5 decades, and now, of course, isn't there for the new development. Marvellous Melbourne. They were so proud of this getting together, this power that radical capital had given, the quarter acre block, the possibility of everybody hoping to own their own home. And of course, Ballarat set the tune. Home ownership here was inordinately high. And of course, because timber was cheap, because the resident areas gave pretty well free land with more or less freehold, and so on and so forth. Now, those are my main points, but I'd like to close by talking about federation, how important Deakin and Quick were in achieving federation for Australia, how the ANA, which was immensely strong in Ballarat, and where, unlike Melbourne, the older generation supported the young native generation in developing their Australian Natives Association as a debating society, as a self-help group, and so on. They were strongly, as you know, for federation. The Gold Towns vote was the highest in the land. Bendigo and Ballarat just outpointed everybody in their vote for federation. And I'd like to conclude by just extolling the virtues, the ethos of these communities, and particularly of this one. That ethos of helping others, of belonging. The militia is a standout case where they elected their officers, where they believed, the officers, that their duty was to bring out the initiatives and the qualities of their men. This is democracy. It's vivid democracy. And of course, at the beginning of the First World War, it was a Ballarat sergeant, the blacksmith, Wiles, who invented a steam mobile cooking system that was to be just everything to the moving army, and is still in use, that system. I think we have to shout about the importance of Victoria in achieving this radical liberal, small L liberal tradition, which passed through from Deakin to Bruce to Menzies to Holt, Gorton, Fraser. I mean, he's a thumping liberal now. Little L, the littlest L that he could ever imagine. And I cannot stop saying, what luck for me that I was asked to write Ballarat's history, because it's given me great insights into our country and a great sense of admiration and pleasure in being a sort of adopted son of a community of such power and strength with an unparalleled history in democracy. I'll drink to you all.